WI3 driving event Wednesday, May 14th. Details at tullybmw.com.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today it's our Friday News Roundup, and here are some of the voices from the week's top news stories.
And I know for some of you, the answer to this issue is, I'm always against the death penalty. For some others, I'm always for it. And I've always been for it. And today, I'm going to vote for repeal. Because I don't know how I would explain to a six-year-old and a four-year-old when that bad person on death row in New Hampshire is executed.
Ladies and gentlemen, Governor Hassan is a good person. But she doesn't know what to do to end the stagnation and get New Hampshire's economy moving again.
This is quite unusual for any institution of higher ed to actually lower tuition, and it's really focused on the needs of our students and to try to enhance affordability and accessibility to public higher education in New Hampshire.
We will be providing in these outreach clinics primary care, preventive health care, and eventually we'll provide some specialty care via telehealth.
Physically, we're still coping. Emotionally, it was a lot longer, a lot harder road. And coming back to the first anniversary, a lot of it comes back. You know, we just felt like we were getting back to a normal kind of process, and now we're back to the first event, and it just brings everything back.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today on The Exchange. Let us hear from you as we examine these and other headlines, including the likelihood that New Hampshireites face a hands-free cell phone future on Granite State highways and byways. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests for this week's Roundup include Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for inviting me.
And we have Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter. Josh, always good to have you with us.
Good morning, Dean.
And Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and the New Hampshire Sunday News. Gary, good to have you back as well.
Good to be here.
Well, gentlemen, we have a lot to talk about this week, so let's get right to it. Josh Rogers, opponents of New Hampshire's death penalty suffered a pretty tough loss in the state legislature yesterday. Tell us what happened.
Well, they ended up deadlocked 12-12 on the bill, 12-12 vote in support of repeal, 12-12 vote to kill the bill. So the bill's on the table now. You know, in theory, it could be removed by a majority vote, but it's unclear if that's going to happen. This was an interesting debate, obviously, for the first time. As far as I know, we have a governor in the corner office in Maggie Hassan who was willing to sign a death penalty repeal. It came out of the House with a good deal of momentum. A debate in some sense pitted anti-death penalty activists, including some former members of law enforcement and some judges, coalition of clergy, the bishops of the Episcopal Diocese and the Manchester Diocese. On the other side, law enforcement were interested in keeping this death penalty on the books. U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte was interested in keeping it on the books, and the effect that this would have had on the prosecution of New Hampshire's lone death row inmate Michael Addison certainly hung over the debate yesterday. And one point, his name came up a lot. Michael Briggs, the Manchester police officer, was killed by us in 2006, and you know there was concern over what a repeal might do to the Addison verdict and whether or not that would increase the likelihood, and it probably would, that that his death sentence would change into a life in prison without parole. So a tough, a tough vote, but it is interesting. I mean, certainly was an opportunity that anti-death penalty activists thought they had a chance to repeal it. But, you know, 12-12 vote, it was, split along party lines. It'll be interesting to see where this goes and if this is a high water mark that, we don't get to again.
I just wanted to say that you go back to the last time it was this close was in the year 2000 when the Senate voted actually 14-10 to repeal. And that was also a 13-11 Republican majority. But at the time, Governor Shaheen just vetoed it. And I know that I know a lot of anti-death penalty activists who are, you know, still upset about that veto years later. But the thing that was interesting, I remember at the time that Governor Shaheen's stated reason was another high-profile case was the mass murder of several people by Carl Draga, who was, you know, he went across two states in northern New Hampshire and in Vermont. And that was her reason for doing it. And it's the same thing now. It's an irony there that you got the sense that if Michael Briggs hadn't been murdered, that there might have been another vote or two. But I know it was probably just untenable for some of those people with Addison sitting in prison there.
It does seem like the Addison death sentence was a real complicating factor with Kelly Ayotte, our senator, getting out and talking about it as a problem. Gary Reno, you know, we heard a lot of social and economic arguments about the death penalty. We hear them around the country. But my sense of the debate this time was there was really kind of a lot of personal struggle among a number of the senators who really were trying to make the right decision here in their own minds.
I think everybody knows the vote came down to two or three senators who really were struggling with it. And it was obvious the two of the particularly that were struggling were Russ Prescott from Kingston and Bob O'Dell from New London. And they split. I mean, O'Dell was a longtime advocate for the death penalty, turned around and said, hey, I have grandchildren. I can't explain this to them if this ever happens. So he's voting for repeal. Prescott, who very religious man, and a lot of people who were working on him on that angle. But he ended up voting for the death penalty, and that's where it was, 12-12. I think what's interesting is it might be a case of bad timing. If this bill actually had come up last year instead of this year, as they're facing an election, they're facing a lot of potential challenges in primaries of Republicans from the Libertarian Tea Party who are already upset about the Medicaid expansion. They might have had a different outcome if they'd come up last year. And if also last year, if we remember about this time, Kelly Ayotte was having her own problems with some gun issues and things like that. She may not have jumped in quite as much as she did.
Well, certainly a setback for advocates of repeal. We had an important court decision this past week with big implications for hospitals and the state budget. For the second time, a New Hampshire Superior Court judge ruled that the Medicaid Enhancement Tax, or MET, as we know, is unconstitutional. And this is the tax that's been levied on hospitals that has also been connected with bringing federal Medicaid dollars into the state. This is a complex tax. Gary Reno, can you give us a little bit of a sense of what it's all about?
Well, we have to go back to 1991, and the state was facing about a $200 million shortfall, and there was no way to make it up. And other states were starting to discover this little loophole in the federal law, Medicaid law, which basically gave a lot of federal money to hospitals that did an awful lot of Medicaid or served a lot of Medicaid patients. So what the state did was they a tax on hospitals, basically net inpatient services. And then they took the money, matched the federal money, and then sent it back to the hospitals with a little extra just to sweeten the pot. And that was fine. Nobody complained. It was working fine until about 2009. When the Fed started to tighten up the rules a little bit and saying you just can't send the money back. There has to be some rationale for what each hospital gets. And then we get to 2011 where we have the very strong Republican-controlled legislature at that time led by Bill O'Brien. And they decided they didn't need to return an awful lot of the money, about $150 million. They decided they'd keep it for the general fund. Now we have a phantom tax that becomes, as they say, a real tax.
And Josh, what are the financial implications of this? We're talking about potentially a hole in the state budget of well over $100 million annually, I believe.
Well, we'll see what they are. I mean, this would not claw back money that the state's already received. So this would be looking forward. So, you know, certainly that hole is going to be something that lawmakers are going to have to deal with. They're not going to have to act immediately, and there's certainly little political rationale for deciding that, you know, oh, we're going to have a solution for this, that we're going to be essentially voting on a new revenue source between now and Election Day. So, you know, we'll see. It's certainly going to be, you know, an issue in the upcoming election. I mean, certainly adds a little pressure to the budget.
And the state has said it's going to appeal the ruling, so this is going to go on for a while.
And they'll appeal it, and you know the Supreme Court may have a different view, but the order from Judge Mangones was pretty clear. He basically said that this is unconstitutional on its face, and we'll see what the Supreme Court makes of his assessment.
Yeah, I think it also might add some fuel to the argument for a casino, I guess, at some point, because they're going to be scrambling around looking for revenue sources, and as we know, the legislature has a long, long history of going for the low-hanging fruit, which is one of the reasons why we're in the situation we're in now.
And, Jeff, I want to stay with you. We had another big vote in the Senate this week, which I think will literally change the way we drive in New Hampshire. We may be talking hands-free on our cell phones, if at all, in 2015. What did the Senate agree to yesterday?
Actually, they agreed to pass a ban that everyone would not be able to drive without while holding onto a cell phone, you know, talking on a cell phone. And I think also there's more restrictions on teenage drivers. But the interesting thing is to me that this is just it's a non-libertarian bill as opposed to
Very live free or die.
Yeah, not very live free or die. Right? That you know, and this is a legislature that, especially a House that has voted on other issues that on the opposite end of the spectrum there. But New Hampshire's would join a lot of other states that have done this. If you just drive down the East Coast, and there's a lot of places where you'll just say, you know, you can't use your cell phone while you're talking. It goes back to the House, and it seems like that's just pretty much a done deal because the governor apparently supports a ban on talking while you're holding onto your phone, which is as a long, long, long time driver on I-89, I'll believe it when I see it.
And Gary Reno, Governor Hassan had said she will read this carefully. What do we read into her careful reading?
Carefully, but if you've read the first part of her statement, she's very concerned about distracted drivers.
The tip off.
I think that it's going to be hard not to let this go, to put it into place. Because, I mean, they got people really, I think, given the state's history, I think most people thought it was going to just get killed in the Senate, but it got stonewalled and it got rolled, and boy, it just has a life of its own.
A little bit of a surprise. We have to take a brief break, but coming up, we're going to talk about community college in New Hampshire getting a little bit more affordable. The past weekend, Granite Staters on both the left and right were talking 2016 presidential politics. So let us know what you think about the presidential race, and keep it here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. You can make sure your membership gift to NHPR goes as far as it can with our corporate match program. Many businesses around the state match your employees' donations to NHPR. You can essentially double the impact of your membership gift. Find out if your company participates at nhpr.org. More of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. It's the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Customize business banking for businesses, professionals, municipalities, and not-for-profit organizations online at centrixbank.com. From Revision Energy in Exeter, providing solar energy systems to New Hampshire families and businesses. More online at revisionenergy.com. And Camp Glenbrook in Marlborough, challenging and inspiring high schoolers in its Falcon Outdoor Leadership Program through wilderness trips and community living. Information at glenbrook.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477 or send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Twitter or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, and that's all one word. Gentlemen, there were a couple of big political stories in New Hampshire this week. We have a new Republican entrant in the governor's race, former BAE Systems CEO Walt Havenstein. He's officially entered the race. Josh, why is Havenstein jumping into the race now?
You know, he says that this was something that he wanted to do. It's also true that he's been somebody that more establishment Republicans in the state and apparently Republicans at the national at the Republican Governors Association have been looking for a candidate who could you know, give Maggie Hassan a stronger run than the other candidate in the race, Andrew Hemingway, would seem to be able to do at this point at least. And, you know, Havenstein, he's 64 years old, has an engineering background, served in the Marines, has enough money so that he could certainly help fund a plausible campaign. He has no record in public office, so we're still kind of teasing out what he thinks. But he had a decent rollout. He was introduced by former Governor Steve Merrill and, you know, some old guard Republicans, people we haven't seen around the State House much. Former Governor Craig Benson was back. Former Senate President Tom Eaton. About half the state Senate was standing by Havenstein's side. Former Congressman Frank Ginta was there. You know, Republicans think that Havenstein will help the whole ticket. You know, it remains to be seen. He more or less kept to a traditional Republican sort of MO in announcing his run. He's, you know, opposed on to new taxes. He said he was supportive of right to work. He, you know, did take some shots at Governor Hassan for supporting gambling. He said it was disappointing to have a governor whose, you know, sort of economic plan was simply based around gambling. You know, we'll see how he does out on the trail, but you know, a reasonable launch, it seemed.
Jeff, let me just – you can comment, but let me just throw in there this complication of the residency requirement that he owned a condo in Maryland for a while. And there's some question about whether or not he's even technically allowed to be on the ballot.
Yeah, there's a question about his domicile, that he had taken some tax breaks while he was living in Maryland when he was the CEO of BAE Systems down there. And he insists that he's always lived in the Lakes region in New Hampshire this whole time. And it's definitely an opening for the Democrats, who have been, I think, will probably go to the ballot law commission at some point to challenge his candidacy.
My understanding is they can't challenge him until he's actually on the ballot.
Yeah, when he gets on the ballot.
Their contention is either he's ineligible for the ballot or committed tax fraud in Maryland, yeah. And they're certainly eager to find out which one.
The interesting thing about it is that we had earlier this year, in this gubernatorial campaign, there was another attempt to have a Republican candidate that people thought would be great. It was Chuck Rolosek, the former restaurateur, and he had another domicile problem as well, which I find kind of, I guess, not amusing but interesting. But the thing about Havenstein that stuck out for me was, I don't know if it was on purpose or if it was just an oversight, but he didn't get around to saying he would veto or an income tax until he was asked by the press about it. He didn't have it in his statement, which didn't seem to be following the pure Republican playbook, because that would be the first thing that comes out of your mouth back in the day. And it did strike me that if it was a Democrat who was declaring his or her candidacy as governor and didn't mention in their statement, I think of some people who would be going crazy about that.
When he was asked if he would favor any taxes, his answer was pretty blunt. It was like sort of heck no, but he did say that, you know, he considered the notion of simply taking a pledge, as I think he said, puffery,
yeah.
But that, you know, that the more interest, which is certainly a new thing.
Absolutely.
And, you know, glad to hear it, having covered many campaign launches and having to hear that. But what he said was the main thing was having policies that would allow you to honor a commitment to.
And,
you know.
And Gary Raynor, let me ask you, first of all, is this a big problem for Andrew Hemingway, who had the field all to himself? And secondly, what about Maggie Hassan? We had a new WMUR Granite State poll out. Some pretty good news for her. So just size up both Hemingway and Hassan going forward.
Well, I think, I mean, with Hemingway and Hassan, you see the two sides of the Republican Party now. I mean, you have the old guard with Havenstein, or as our colleague Kevin Landrigan called it, the Empire Strikes Back, and and with Hemingway we have the new libertarian Tea Party side of the party, but obviously Havenstein's going to be a lot better funded than Hemingway is, but you got to wonder who's going to turn out for the primary, and that's always the issue with the Republican primaries, and the old guard has been staying home, and the new guard, if you will, has been dominating in terms of the people they're putting up on the Republican.
Well, there is this theory out there that the combination of Scott Brown and Walt Havenstein will significantly increase turnout for the primary.
And I think more even than the races that they're in, I mean, the real issue here is what's happening down the ticket. And if these guys can get 45% or so, then you're not going to have the bleeding you would have had further down the ticket in the state Senate and the executive council and House. So it helps the Republican Party in a big way. But are they going to – I mean, the issue is what happens in the primary? Do they even get through there? Yeah.
I mean, until you see these guys out on the trail, yeah. it's yeah. really right. hard to know how well they're connecting. It's one yeah. thing to have yeah. a press conference.
And we don't get to see the debates until September in the yeah. primary anyway. Yeah.
And, if you follow the blogs from a lot of the Tea Party types and libertarian types, they're not happy about this Havenstein. They don't like this whole top-down thing where they're picking the candidate. They're also not happy about Scott Brown. So it could also work to energize them in the primary. And as we know, in the primary, it's usually more conservative voters are voting. So it's possible that Hemingway could do better than people might have thought.
Yeah, Gary, those WMUR poll numbers for Maggie Hassan, good news?
Certainly, when you're looking at a 59% approval rating, that's certainly good news. I mean, it's not Lynch numbers, but they're very yeah. few people are going to get Lynch numbers.
Well, and I think the polling data also showed that something like 89% of voters have no opinion of Havenstein.
Yeah. That's the real interesting part. I mean, 89% don't know who he is. 84% don't know who Hemingway is. These guys have a long, long, long way to go. Yeah.
And just the simple fact that, if you were to look at history, what two governors in the last century basically have been tossed after yeah. one term when they're seeking another yeah. term.
And so it's not likely.
It's going to be interesting to see on what issues Havenstein and Hemingway seek to essentially disqualify Hassan from getting that other term. And since we've had a split legislature and she's worked in concert with Republicans in the state Senate on the state budget, for instance, and on Medicaid, although that's we'll see how popular that ends up being. She's not giving them a lot of obvious openings.
So you think she could withstand a 2010 type of the Republican wave that essentially took her out of the Senate in 2010, if that were to happen?
We'll find out. But there's no clear opening.
Yeah, I think I've talked to several Republicans, just voters, not people involved necessarily in politics, and they have favorable things to say about her. The worst they say is, I don't have anything bad to say about her. And that doesn't help when you're for a challenger, especially when it's the Republican who's trying to convince Republican voters to throw out someone who they feel pretty good about.
Yeah, so we're going to obviously be watching the governor's race, particularly once we get into the primary season over the summer in September. Josh Rogers, another interesting political story from the last week. We saw a number of potential Republican presidential candidates, Rand Paul, Mike Huckabee, Ted Cruz, Newt Gingrich, even Donald Trump made an appearance up here in the Granite State. And they all descended on New Hampshire for a so-called Freedom Summit. What was this summit all about?
Well, it was sponsored by Americans for Prosperity and Citizens United, and kind of catacall of Republicans from the sort of activist wing of the party, people kicking the tires on presidential runs. It was last Saturday was first nice day of the spring, and it was a big crowd. It stayed indoors all day. Most people there were certainly energized to hear Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. Huckabee, Trump, Gingrich were there. As you might expect in such a gathering, lots of pretty red meat talk on, Obama, Obamacare, Common Core. It was interesting to look at the ways in which Ted Cruz and Rand Paul went about sort of positing their visions for the future of the party. Rand Paul was talking about, we need to do more to reach out to communities that don't support us, minorities, people who live in cities. We need to spread our message. And Ted Cruz, on the other hand, said, we need to, be bold by, retaining the traditional three-legged stool of social conservatives, fiscal conservatives, and sort of hawkish foreign policy types. And so, Cruz and Paul are the people who seem to be most clearly angling for presidential runs. And there were a lot of people in this crowd who were energized.
Jeff, we'll go to you in a moment. Let me just remind our listeners, it is the Friday News Roundup. If you'd like to join in, you can call us at 1-800-892-6477. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And you can also go to Twitter or Facebook. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. Jeff Feindel, we're talking about this Freedom Summit. Can we learn anything about the direction of the Republican Party from listening to these candidates?
Yeah, well, I think actually we can learn something about the direction of the Republican Party by the response that someone who wasn't there got, and that was Jeb Bush, the former governor of Florida.
Who got booed, apparently.
He got booed resoundingly when his name was mentioned by Mr. Trump, I believe. It's striking. I mean, I think it reflects more on the attendance of this summit than anything else. But you know, he was booed specifically because of a comment he made that was in favor of immigration reform, and he was ridiculed for it. He said that people who came to from other countries to here breaking the law were doing an act of love for their family or something along that line, and he was immediately ridiculed, and it did not sit well with this group. But I do think it does. I think the point is making the point that the people who were in that room do not necessarily reflect the entire Republican Party, but it definitely reflects a very strong key part of the party. You know, we didn't see very many evangelicals there. There certainly weren't very many mainstream Republicans there, and it's interesting to see it. I mean, it goes back to the conversation we had about the governor's race. The party isn't right now. The Republican Party right now is. Got some fence mending to do within its own party.
Yeah, Gary, let me ask you, and I get this asked all the time. Why are we doing this almost 2 years before the presidential primary? Is there something to be gained strategically from these folks for coming up here so early?
Oh, I mean they're up here looking for the activists, basically.
So the organizations,
so we can put together organizations when the time comes, and they're trying to find out what they need to do, how their message is going over. We almost have the around-the-clock presidential campaigns. Hardly one is over, and we have more coming down the road. I mean, it just seems to be a constant here in this state.
One thing that was also interesting, the degree to which, like, the national press, in some sense this was almost, there was a room full of activists based in New Hampshire and, people from Massachusetts as well. But, then there were more national reporters there than local reporters, and this was all over cable news. And while on the one hand they're up here, meeting, shaking hands, pressing the flesh with locals, this is also contributing to, what is increasingly the sort of made-for-TV aspects of the New Hampshire primary that isn't really the way it used
almost
to be.
Almost a platform for this national discourse.
It was programming for C-SPAN.
Yeah,
actually.
Jeff, we should mention that across town, at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics, progressives were cheering Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He was gave a speech to a well-attended crowd. I don't know if people think he'll be the Democratic nominee, but he seems to be flirting with a presidential run. What might the impact of that be on the Democratic race?
It would be interesting, first of all, because Senator Sanders is an independent. He's not a member of the Democratic Party right now. He has said he's an avowed socialist, and he has some very interesting stands. And actually, he has worked across the aisle on certain things, especially on various NSA-related stuff, on privacy issues. The interesting thing about it is that right now, there's just like a vacuum in the Democratic Party. Except, well, I guess maybe it's not a vacuum, but there's Hillary there, Hillary Clinton, and nobody else. And there's a feeling among certainly on the progressive side, the left side of the Democratic Party, they're not happy with having another Clinton there, and there's a void, and they're trying to find people. That's why you hear the name of Senator Warren from Massachusetts. You see Senator Sanders figuring out this stuff, but it's looking more and more like if Hillary Clinton doesn't run, I don't know if the Democrats know what to do. Mm-hmm. But I do find it interesting that Senator Sanders, he's right next door. He has a lot of following in New Hampshire. I'm not sure if he has any in Iowa or
Gary,
anyplace
else. Gary, they say the Upper Valley is Bernie Sanders' country.
Well, I think they're in Vermont anyway up there.
I mean, we always talk about the People's Republic of Keene and the Upper Valley. Certainly, there's a good following for someone like Bernie Sanders there. But, I mean, it is true, as Jeff said. I mean, the progressives in the Democratic Party in New Hampshire have not been happy for quite some time about some of the candidates that have risen to the surface, both on the presidential level and at the state level. Yeah.
Josh, is it worth it for Democratic hopefuls other than Hillary Clinton to spend time here?
Well, sure. Why not? I mean, we're a long ways away. While there's nothing to suggest that Hillary Clinton won't run, we don't know for sure if she's going to run. And as Jeff says, there is a hunger for somebody other than Hillary Clinton among a certain slug of the Democratic electorate here. History would indicate that the more time you know, familiarity can breed contempt with any politician, and certainly when the Clinton apparatus gets going, there are some things that, you know, rub a certain amount of people the wrong way about them and their whole style of politics. But at the same time, you know, the Clintons, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, are very, very popular among, you know, most of the Democratic Party, and most people would expect if she were to run here that she would win here. But we are, of course, a long ways away. But, it's obviously up to the voters.
But if, you know, if you remember back in 2008, she didn't have the easiest time of winning this primary.
Yeah, well, you know,
but she did win the primary.
Oh, no, yeah. She did. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I think we can count on.
But sort of Lyndon Johnson in 1968, and he left the race.
Opponent, well, I think too. we can count on Bernie Sanders to keep things interesting. You know, he's often outraged. He's always interesting.
Yeah.
It was
very colorful.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm sure he'll be back. Jeff Feingold, changing topics now. The students enrolled in New Hampshire's community colleges got some good news on tuition this week. We always hear about tuition rising. This is something a little different.
Yeah, actually, it was very encouraging, actually, for people who have been following the unrelenting rise in education college costs over the last 20 or 30 years. But I guess the community college system voted to reduce their tuition by about 5%, about $200. Take the in-state per credit cost from $200 to $200 from it's now $210. And I guess what it means, if you took a full 12-credit course, you'd save about $240 over the semester, It doesn't seem like a lot of money, but in terms of where the trend has been going in college tuition and other costs, it's really of some good news. That's probably something we haven't seen in a long time. I know the community college system froze tuition last year, and then they got their full funding restored, and I think as part of like a goodwill gesture, said, well, we're going to reduce this. But the interesting thing about the community college system is it's headed by Ross Gatell, who's former professor at UNH.
Right.
And he's an economist, and he has been advocating for a greater role of the education system, the higher education system, specifically in New Hampshire, but also the community college system. And he's been working at it. He's actually, in a way, putting his money where his mouth is. He's been working really hard to have partnerships with businesses to try to figure out what kind of workforce they want. And it's this is an encouraging sign.
Gary?
Well, you know, the last budget that we had added back all the money that the community college system had lost under the previous budget. Didn't add back all the money that the university system had lost. But both, you know, the university and the community college system agreed to freeze tuition. In this coming year, community college gets more money than they actually were getting before. This helps it to reduce
so good
the
news.
Which is instructive, I think, for the legislature.
And
actually,
enrollment's going way up, too.
Yeah, we need to take one more break. But coming up, state lawmakers are considering legislation to at least temporarily ban the use of a controversial new painkiller. We'll find out more after a short break. So keep it right here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the New York Police Department drops a Muslim surveillance program, and the CBO lowers its cost estimate for the Affordable Care Act. Then, Ukraine's interim government struggles to rein in pro-Russian militants. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from the law firm of Orr & Reno, bringing sound judgment and a practical approach to New England's legal challenges for more than 65 years, online at orr-reno.com. And from Nashua Crossings, senior living in Nashua, holding an open house every Saturday in April, offering tours of assisted living in their new memory care neighborhood. Details at 882-2898. It's 940. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Monday on Exchange, we'll check in on the expanded gambling debate. Join us by calling in at 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Twitter or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. It is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today. I have three guests with me in the studio, Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader, and Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. And gentlemen, we can't let the hour pass without noting that earlier this week, many Granite Staters marked the one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing. Gary Reno, this really seemed to resonate with people. It seemed like a lot of people really paused to commemorate this anniversary.
It sure did. I mean, we went obviously people have been very moved by all of this and the results of what happened. Sports Illustrated did a cover. They had a call for anybody that wanted to come down to the finish line. And just hundreds or thousands of people showed up for that. I mean, we had a big service in Boston and then a memorial at the finish line. A lot of people from New Hampshire were down there. I mean, Senator Shaheen was meeting with some of the police that went down to help out. It was a very solemn occasion and just a real reminder of what happened about a year ago and how it can happen here. It doesn't always have to be somewhere else.
Jeff, your reflections on Boston 1 year ago? We've got the marathon coming up next week.
Yeah, I have to say that it really was just a somber day. It makes you it was a moment that is a lot like 9/11 or so many other moments where you just can't forget where you were and what you were thinking at the time. What's really is just moving to me are the people who were injured, who are making attempts to run the marathon again, and all the people. I guess there's 4,000 more runners this year than last year. It's like almost like an act of solidarity and I guess
9,000, I believe.
Oh, 9,000 more runners than last year, which is just remarkable considering. Oh, we have the running expert over there. which is remarkable, considering just a year ago the horror, the fear, the panic that had overcome all of New England when after the bombing had occurred, and it really is quite a testament to the city of Boston and to the whole area about how. Well, I guess the word is strong that they've been.
Yeah, Josh, it's really been amazing how occasionally a phrase captures a moment. And this Boston Strong really has become a kind of a rallying cry for the region beyond, I think, anything anyone would have expected.
Certainly. I've really not had much out of me. It's obviously a horrendous thing. And, hopefully something like that never happens again.
Changing topics now, the state lawmakers are debating whether to place an 18-month moratorium on the painkiller Zohydro. This is a new painkiller. People may not know much about it. Josh Rogers, what are we looking at here in terms of a ban?
Well, the proposal, which is being championed by Republican Senator Andy Sanborn of Bedford, would be an 18-month moratorium on the drug. It's been on the market since March. It's designed for patients who essentially need round-the-clock pain relief. And it came under it was approved by the FDA, but some internally didn't think it should be approved because it lacked adequate, in their minds, tamper resistance. Essentially, you can crush it and the time release capacities, the time release protections go away. Attorneys general in 28 states, including New Hampshire, want the FDA to reconsider the decision. Of Vermont and Massachusetts have both moved to slow its arrival. Judge in Massachusetts said that the Massachusetts ban wasn't going to fly. And so we'll see. Obviously, opioid problems and, pills on the street and, drug overdoses are a nationwide problem and, particularly in northern New England. And so we'll see
Do we think that the problem is getting worse, or do we just think that there's sort of more coverage of it now? It seems like there's been a lot of stories about heroin and other just prescription painkillers, et cetera, have become a real problem.
Well, I mean, the statistics would indicate that drug overdoses of, narcotics and or pills in concert with alcohol is a growing problem in New Hampshire for several years. I believe that the number of drug-related deaths have outpaced traffic accidents and, to what degree some of that may be due to safer cars. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that people are using a lot of dangerous drugs and that this has, been deemed a crisis by governors in several states. And it'll be interesting to see where this but, where this
Jeff goes. If it was over if it was the ban was overturned by a or the attempt to ban it was shot down by a judge in Massachusetts, you know, why would how would New Hampshire be different?
I'm not quite clear how that could happen. It's absolutely you're right. I think what's interesting to this whole thing is that how it got to, on the market in the first place, because the FDA approved it even though its own advisory committee said we shouldn't have, you know, you shouldn't have this on the market. And then something else that's interesting, and I don't know how else to, I'll just say what it's an interesting fact that the manufacturer of this painkiller is also the manufacturer of a drug that's used to fight opiate addiction. But I guess that's, you know, what the free market does.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because a lot of the hospitals are all taking this on their own and saying they're not going to have their doctors or physicians prescribe this. I mean, Dartmouth-Hitchcock is one that says we're not going to do this. There are a couple others in Vermont and some various others that say we don't believe this is a really good idea, and so we're not going to do it ourselves. So, I mean, it's kind of again, I would like to rather see kind of things fall out and see how that works, particularly with the federal judge ruling before the state starts to jump in. And I can't imagine that they're going to be really willing to act on this.
I think the real effort is by the part of – I know that Senator Shaheen and others have urged the FDA to reconsider the decision and take it off the market. And I think that's going to be probably the only really effective way to do it at this point.
So we're going to be watching this to see if they do ban it and if it is upheld in the courts. Josh Rogers, we've just learned that six-term state senator Bob O'Dell says he will not seek re-election this fall. He's a Republican from New London representing the Upper Valley. What are the implications of this?
Well, he's actually from Leominster, I believe. But in any case, you know, we played a little tape of him early on the death penalty.
Right.
He's
right.
One of the senators who changed his mind. He's chairman of Ways and Means. He's been in the Senate for a while, you know, well-regarded in both parties, someone who worked closely with Governor Lynch and has worked well with Senate leaders as well, you know, moderate voice on the Senate, somebody that people respected. And, you know, in a statement, he said essentially that he's time to leave the Senate after six terms, and he looks forward to, you know, spending more time with his family and other things. So somebody who will be missed. He was facing a primary challenge from a more conservative member of the Republican Party, J.P. Marzullo, currently vice chair of the party. You know, Bob O'Dell's going to be missed at the State House.
Yeah, and actually
Gary and then Jeff.
I think it's going to be a real loss because Bob was one of those people who could work across party lines. And he was somebody that you could count on actually, you know, when the push comes to shove, he usually did the right thing. And that's not always the case. He certainly was a moderate Republican. He wasn't the darling of the Tea Party, that's for sure. But he was involved in the Medicaid expansion agreement that got done, and I think that's why he was being targeted, and that was, I'm sure, he's going to say, I've been there 6 years. Why put up with this any longer?
Jeff?
Yeah, and actually, you know, when you look at how it plays out, that is an interesting seat because that's not a given Republican scene. That's really in play, and it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see what will happen. You know, who's the Democratic candidate coming in there, and it's possible the Democrats could retake that seat.
So it might be an opportunity for a pickup.
Yes.
I just want to remind our listeners, this is the new Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or go to Twitter and find us, or post on Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Gentlemen, we have an interesting story developing in Belmont, at Belmont High School. Students at the high school are considering making a change to its mascot, which is currently the Red Raiders. Jeff, what is the story all about?
It's part of this national movement to ban these these offensive mascots. I mean, I do subscribe to that.
The Red Raider is a Native American. Must be a Native American symbol.
Well, it's not the name so much. It's the logo. It's a you know, an Indian chief, so to speak, and you know, and it's referring to you know, some warriors or something, which is, you know, it's all over the country, high schools, colleges, and of course we know of many of professional baseball, football teams that have it. The most obvious is the Redskins, which apparently that's feeling the most pressure.
But their owner has been fairly resistant.
Yeah,
to
and that well, that is, and actually, that is the most offensive name of them all. Actually, but I find it interesting that the students at Belmont are generating this. It's part of they found out that there's their school was one of the schools listed on this website that has mascots that people in the American Indians find offensive. It's met with some resistance, like anything else, because I know if you can go back long enough to when Dartmouth got rid of its
they were mascot, the Indians, I believe.
Yeah, and that took it's hard to convince alumni, especially, but it's a different the attitude toward these things is changing. It's really a reflection on a younger generation that's more sensitive than previous generations.
Gary? I was going to bring up the whole issue with Dartmouth a while ago, where they had
the big green now.
The big green, yeah. As opposed to the Indians. It was a big issue on campus for a while.
I will say
that. And you ought to know, Dean.
Well, when I was up there, it was in fact the big green. But I remember going to football games, and there were alums handing out styrofoam tomahawks. They're sort of the underground Indian group. There's millions of dollars that go into branding at the professional level, certainly,
yes.
and marketing. So, but it sounds like they haven't made any decisions yet. This is kind of an ongoing conversation.
The students went out, reached out to the community, and they're asking them for what their opinions are. So, knowing the town of Belmont, there'll be a lot of opinions, and there'll be a discussion of this. It's not clear what they'll do, but it is something that's been happening across the country, and it's probably fair to say eventually it will be changed. Maybe not immediately, but at some point.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that the students have kind of taken this on themselves and are sort of driving the discussion. We need to talk about some good news for veterans in New Hampshire, particularly those who receive health care from the Veterans Administration Hospital in White River Junction. Josh Rogers, it looks like they won't have to drive quite as far as they once did, particularly from the North Country.
No, the VA has announced that there'll be a couple of clinics up there, and certainly the extent to which New Hampshire, which has a high population of veterans, has the services available to serve them in the way they like has been an issue for some time. The notion of having a freestanding veterans hospital, full service hospital, has been a political issue that the delegation's been involved in. This was announced by Senator Shaheen and Ayotte, and it means that a lot of folks in the North Country may not have to, schlep over to Vermont.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's been something that they've wanted for a long, long time up there. And there's a lot of veterans who live up there. Who
At a time when there's been real strains on the healthcare system for the VA.
Absolutely.
It's not only just one. They're going to be opening up two clinics first. They're going to open up one in Colebrook, which is very far north, as we all know. And then once that is up and running in like September or October, then they're going to work to open another one in Berlin.
So this sounds like it's just the beginning of a longer process of dealing with the
whole issue of healthcare for veterans and in the far reaches of
Plus
the
also, if you think about the healthcare delivery system up in the North Country as a whole has been under a lot of stress over the last several years, and this will help in a lot
of
ways.
This is a good beginning for them. Finally, it is baseball season, even with the cold temperatures we've had recently. And while Jeff Feingold, while we know the Yankees aren't particularly popular up in these parts.
What do you mean by that?
Well, for a few transplanted Brooklynites, perhaps. But one famous Yankees son is about to spend a summer here playing ball in New Hampshire. Tell us a little bit about Mariano Rivera Jr.
Well, Mariano Rivera Jr. has a famous name. Even people who aren't Yankee fans know who Mariano Rivera Sr., his father, was. He just retired last year.
Hall of Famer, for sure.
Inarguably the greatest relief pitcher of all time, I will say that. His son is a 20-year-old student at Iona College in New York and is on the baseball team. And apparently there's some relationship between the Laconia team, New England Collegiate Baseball League team up in Laconia, relationship with Iona, with the coach there, and they send a couple of players every year. And this year, Mariano Rivera Jr., who's a pitcher, will be playing for the team. And I find it interesting, as a Yankee fan, I'm hoping that, maybe his father will rent a house on Winnipesaukee and he'll be at all the games, all the home games. But, he's 20 years old, and people who followed the career of his father, he's not exactly at the same level of his father at 20. But it's fun to see. I'm sure it'll bring some, help the attendance of the team up there, which is always good to see. It's always good because baseball is still a great game.
Any Red Sox fans here who want to get in the obligatory
Not about
go play somewhere other? Anybody? You're all,
I mean, I don't follow baseball terribly okay. closely, but Mariano Rivera, obviously.
Even you know, non-baseball.
An impressive person and somebody of good character, apparently.
Absolutely. Yeah. And these college leagues are summer leagues are a way that kind of college students can get this sort of make a step up to the minors.
There's a team but in Keene as well. And,
I think out of Cape
some
Cod.
Some of us have, remember the fourth game in the league championship series in Boston and the role that – that he played.
Oh,
in that,
gee, that is so low. That is so low.
Well, gentlemen, we're just about out of time. And on Monday, Brady Carlson is going to be guest hosting and talking about the gambling debate, which is one of the things we've been talking about here every week. But in the brief time we have remaining, let me hear a little bit about what you all are going to be focused on next week. And Jeff, I'll start with you.
Well, actually, we're looking at a lot of bills that the that are going through the legislature right now that have been endorsed and supported by people at the AFL-CIO and other people in AFL-CIO and other people in the labor movement, and it's a series of bills, that seem to have some chance of getting through, and we'll be tracking how those go in the weeks to come.
Gary,
well, I think the big issue next week will be the gas tax. The gas tax is going to be on the House agenda. Not that anybody thinks it's not going to pass, because it probably will, but that certainly has been a bill that has gotten an awful lot of attention in the last few months. And the other one that's coming up is the gambling. The House Ways and Means Committee is supposed to be meeting early next week to decide what their recommendation is. I'm predicting 13-11 against.
So you think that it's not going to go anywhere?
No.
Josh Rogers, what are you going to be looking at?
Well, I'll probably be with Gary on the gas tax and gambling, and it'll be interesting to see if this ruling on the Medicaid tax breathes any new life into gambling as this moves on.
Yeah, it seems like a fairly arcane tax issue, but on the other hand, we are now hearing some gambling proponents using that as a potential way to kind of make a new argument for gambling. Well, I know we're going to continue to monitor all of these issues in the coming weeks, and I want to thank all of you for joining me today. Jeff Feingold is editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, thanks so much.
That was great being here.
Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter. Josh, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
The pleasure was mine, too.
And Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and the New Hampshire Sunday News. Gary, thanks for joining us once again.
You're most welcome, Dean.
I know we're all going to be talking over the coming weeks about all of this stuff and a lot more. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The energy engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Katie Ortiz. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And Keith, good luck at the Boston Marathon next week. And I'm Dean Spiliotis, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, one more roll of the dice for expanded gambling in the Granite State. We'll look at the latest bill and what its odds may be in the House. Then stories from the Vietnam War, as told by veterans who attended Dartmouth College. And later, controversy and concern across New England over the new super painkiller, Zohydro. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us all next week for The Exchange. Every morning, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio. New Hampshire weather partly sunny for today with high temperatures around 50 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR listeners and from AMD Lumber and Home Centers, featuring windows and doors by Marvin and Integrity for remodeling or replacement projects in Pembroke, Moultonboro, and at ablumber.com. And Centrix Bank, see beyond with Centrix Bank, banking solutions customized to your business. Information available at centrixbank.com.
The These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. President Obama makes the case that his signature healthcare law is working. He reports 8 million people have signed up for insurance through federal and state marketplaces. 35% of the enrollees are under age 35. The Justice Department reports